Yeah, this is an interesting topic because it was something I never really planned to start talking about online. Like, I didn't necessarily want to be the guy that's chatting away about porn. And I was someone that grew up just like Googled stuff when I was in my teenage years, discovered that
world,
thought, wow, look at this. This is pretty crazy, super stimulating for your brain, and never thought anything of it. Just saw it as a part of my life, as I think many men do, but it's just like, and women, but it's just like an unspoken component of our society that we're just not considering could be influential. Again, if you look at the timelines of mental health and something like this getting really popular, you could see a big, big correlation. And for me, it was something I was just very curious, what happens if you don't watch it? And I was studying the dopamine system, this like pleasure system. Dopamine, for context, is all really responsible for our motivation, our drive. I wanted to build a good career. I wanted to build the company. And I thought, is this something that's zapping some of my drive away? And I started just doing it. Like, I'd do 2 weeks without watching it. And I thought, wow, I can feel like a big difference here. Started recommending it to my friends. They're like, well, it doesn't do anything. And they would take 2 weeks off and then message me like, this is crazy what it's done to how driven I feel.
Hello and welcome to another episode of For Soul's Sake, a podcast in which I aim to give you candid conversation on spirituality, holistic wellness, alongside a host of wonderful guests. Today is a wonderful episode alongside an amazing person who I will introduce in a second, but thank you so, so much for coming back every single week. I deeply appreciate you coming back to listen, learn, and grow with us. Today we've got a wonderful person sat opposite me. His name's TJ Power. He is a neuroscientist, something different. Not all just about yoga and woo-woo people, and you know, we've got some serious science going on today, people. Neuroscientist, entrepreneur, and mental health content creator, mostly known for co-founding Neurofy, a fast-growing startup that trains companies and schools across Europe how to radically transform mental health. I'm in love already. Over the past 10 years, through deep research and study, TJ has developed this new scientifically backed approach to increased mental wellness in the world. This has seen him deliver his bespoke training to over 15,000 students since launch. TJ, honor, a privilege. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited for the conversation.
Yeah, it's gonna be awesome. I'm gonna dive straight into the deep end. Neuroscience and spirituality. What the hell? Do they go hand in hand? Is that even a possibility?
100%. It's a conversation as soon as we engaged with this, I was excited to dive into, because my brand and presence online is much more scientifically based. And as someone that has gone pretty deep down the spiritual route, as I've explored all of the spiritual practices, but with neuroscience being the first thing I kind of studied and learned about, I've really seen how the neuroscience just validates a lot of the spiritual practices that we've had for thousands of years, which is, yeah, very cool to see.
Wow. It validates spirituality. I mean, tell me more, like, how does neuroscience validate spirituality?
There are just so many core practices that I've learned as I've gone down the research. When you go into things like breathing or community or meditation or singing or any of these practices, you see like that they have huge neuroscientific impact on chemicals in our brain and how our body functions and things like that.
Wow. So, I mean, in terms of like prayer and meditation, what's the kind of research that comes out when it comes, what does it do? Like, what's the workings in the brain?
Yeah. So for a bit of back context, I kind of go down the route of these four different brain chemicals, and the spiritual practices would affect them in different ways. We have this one called dopamine, super, super famous one in our modern world, probably the most known, because we all know scrolling the social media feeds or drinking booze or something like that can affect the dopamine. So dopamine is the first one. Then we have oxytocin. This is the one that kind of connects us up as people. Serotonin is one that calms us down. And then endorphins kind of affect stress and physical health. And when you go in something like meditation and prayer, you see a big rise in this serotonin chemical. And serotonin, as I say, it's responsible for kind of our emotional state. It calms us. And you see in the research when people go through these practices, huge benefits to that system.
Dopamine. I mean, I know that in one sense, spirituality is meant to do with, yes, affecting anxiety and dealing with bodily stress. But most of it's to do with the inner work of like the soul, etc. And I think this is still valuable, because I think a lot of people do first get attracted to meditation and spirituality because it does relieve them of mental stress. And were the tests done where it I can only imagine where they're patching people's brains up. And I mean, how do they get that data? How do they, just observe someone in their practice and then see what the results come out as? And
yeah, so largely in terms of the research, you have something called an fMRI scanner, which you put someone in like an MRI scanner, but a little bit more based on how your brain functions, and you put someone in and you take them through meditative practices or breathing practices and assess the alterations in the brain. And it is super interesting. I mean, people have done these practices for a long time, and I think the human mind now is very, very overwhelmed, and we need to connect back into these more traditional ways. I'm constantly spending my time thinking, like, what is the cause of this mental health challenge? Like, it's really changing at the moment. Ever since COVID, mental health has changed a lot, and I go into a lot of different areas, social media and tech and stuff like that. But I do think, especially across the Western world, the rise in atheism and like a lack of belief in something and purpose for something really correlates. Like, if you look at mental health and look at atheism, there's a very connected timeline. So
that's far out. There's a correlation between atheism and mental health decline.
Challenges. Yeah, for sure.
Wow.
If you look over the last like 20 or 30 years, a huge amount of the Western world, like for example, my family and beyond me, like grandparents and stuff like that, they would have been a little bit more Christian, followed those practices, had church, community, singing, prayer, all of these things. And gradually it's getting filtered out of the Western world. And I think there is just like a massive correlation between that.
Mm. I mean, there would be people, the naysayers, that would say that beyond even having a divine connection, these things are just good in and of themselves, like singing, dancing, community, you know, all these. They're still valuable, but maybe we just don't get them anymore because of, because in one sense, here's the question. Do you think that people are better off not having, religious, spiritual communities? Because that way, at least we're being honest that, yeah, there is no such thing as God or divinity. Or do you think that we should just, even if there isn't a God out there, a divinity out there, or a spiritual connection, we should just do these practices because they are good for our bodies and minds?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think when you look fundamentally at the practices, like our brain really needs these practices. Like we spent, dependent on what your belief system is around evolution and things like that, but we spent a huge amount of time evolving, like living outside in communities, in tribal groups and things like that. And these practices were core. We had a lot of stuff, meditative stuff, singing, chanting, very much belonging to a community, contribution, service. Like that was the core of being a human, basically. And our modern world, I think it can like orient you a little bit more towards a more selfish way of life, to be honest. Like, I think it can make you very focused on yourself. Social media makes you constantly look at your own profile and things like that. And I love the idea of belief in a God and having something to serve towards. Like, I found adding prayer into my life, even though I didn't grow up in like a religious family, having something that I'm aiming for and like speaking to and communicating with has been wonderful for my mental health. Wow. So I think God's amazing. And I think if you can't kind of connect into that idea, just the practices themselves are extremely good for how our brain works.
Well, you heard it here first, people. Even if you don't believe in God, join a spiritual community. It'll do you, your mental health some good. And I think that's really beautiful that that it's being backed by, the science, backed by. I think a lot of people see that there's an antagonism between spirituality and science, and that they're two different vehicles, that you cannot use one to prove the other and you cannot use one to validate the other. And I think that what you're doing is really powerful in being able to show that they can be married up and can be held hand in hand. Do you get any kind of pushback from other neuroscientists, people? I mean, is there a different school of thought as well, or do you feel that everyone's harmoniously also thinking on the same train?
I think this is one of our challenges for people, because we get so convinced of like one way of thinking, and social media, again, it really does that. Like, it really strengthens whatever you believe and it really validates us. And when we scroll just for
quite
context,
polarizing.
Yeah. When we have our belief system like validated and approved that it's correct, we actually get a dopamine hit from that.
Oh, really?
We get joy off knowing we're right, effectively. And that can strengthen like, oh, it must be science. It must be science. And it's great that we've created this whole scientific understanding of the world. That's my whole career, effectively, so I'm not opposed to it. But I think the one-track mind of, oh, because we've figured out that science would have been a part of the creation of the world, let's let go of what everyone else believed for hundreds of thousands of years. I don't think that's necessarily the way to go. And it would be very hard to disagree with the idea that these practices have a positive impact on the brain. There's not like negative research as to the value. So even though most neuroscientists may not have as much of a spiritual practice because they might be more in that style of thinking, I think it'd be very hard to invalidate what it shows.
Do you have a spiritual practice that you have every day, or is it something that you're developing? Do you have an affinity to a practice perhaps?
Yeah, that's interesting to dive into, because I was someone that, as I say, wasn't very connected to these ideas at all. And throughout my young years, went very, very into the party lifestyle. Yep. From maybe about 14, 15 up to about 22, I went basically as hard as you can down the route of having a good time like that. And when I was finishing my third year of university, I was like, I need to really get into like a healthy and focused spot if I want to build a cool career and nail the neuroscience masters and all that kind of stuff. And that's when I jumped into like a meditation app for the first time.
Cool.
Discovered that it was impossible to spend time in the quiet, like really, really hard for me.
Yeah.
And I think many people can relate to this now, like not even being able to go for like a 20-minute walk without headphones, I think a lot of people struggle with. So meditation was the first thing that honestly was like the biggest catalyst in my life. It redirected my whole way of being. I committed this idea to like a 90 days. I was going to do it for the whole summer and like make sure I did 10 minutes each day to like try and ease myself into it.
That's a good period of time.
It was good. And I made like a WhatsApp group with my friends that I thought could also benefit from following a similar thing. And that was kind of the origin of creating the business, really, because I saw you could put groups together and train them in ideas. And yeah, that meditation practice evolved. I started doing longer meditations, and now it's largely, yeah, meditation. I like music. I sing every day. I'm not a good singer, but I find it very good for me.
That's cool.
And I have like a gratitude and kind of celebration of accomplishment process that kind of ties into that.
You said something interesting, that people can't go 20 minutes without, you know, just being in silence. I think, you know, there's one quote, I hope I don't murder it here, but it's something like, if you don't feel good in your own company, you're in the worst company. And that, you know, a lot of people find it difficult. We suffer from this thing that I heard called crowded loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
That we find it difficult to just, you know, we've got a plethora of different interactions, be it on the phone, be it, you know, commitments. We have to go here and there to meet people. But still, we still feel quite lonely when we're just in silence and with us. Is there anything, I don't know, neuroscientifically or anything that you have to say about, you know, people dealing with loneliness?
Loneliness is massive now. And it's very interesting that you could be lonely in a world that's so connected. But if you took like the two examples of like a city where there's tons and tons of people, and then you had like a really small tribe in the jungle, it's much more likely that someone in a city is actually going to be lonely even though they're around way more people. So it's definitely possible, that idea of
so crowded, interesting, right?
Crowded loneliness. And we as humans, we're not actually designed to have tons and tons of connections. Like there's this chap called Dunbar who did a lot of research into tribal groups and what kind of numbers we were optimized to live in. And he found for the longest period of time throughout human history, when we were thriving, we were in tribal groups of about 150.
Maximum
150, we'd nail it at that. And you would be like, you'd know everyone in that group, but not necessarily be deeply connected to them, because you'd all have your different ways of contributing. And then it would tear down and down. And it says that we're likely able to hold on to and really like nurture 5 relationships in our lives.
Wow.
To be like super connected to 5 people, contribute to their life, have them contribute to yours. And I think one of the challenges now in the modern world is we're like hyper connected, but it's making the level of connection a lot shallower. And depth of connection, that's something we go deep into teaching about, because a lot of people feel too kind of busy for these like main connections in their life, even for like with their wife at home sitting on the sofa whilst on their phone still working in the evening, like all these concepts that are leading to, yeah, that idea of loneliness.
Thank you for sharing that. And you also mentioned singing as well, and obviously like that's something I love to do, and
yeah,
any day that I don't get to sing, it's a tragedy. It's let's just put it honestly, it's a tragedy. Yeah, I mean, tell me more about how that can help us and why that's you know, important as a practice.
Singing is ridiculous for our health. And it was really interesting for me, because when I came to that event the first time, I didn't meet you, but I saw you. And The experience that like first 20, 30 minutes before Russell came on was like honestly one of the best of my life.
This was a Russell Brand community event.
Yeah.
Cool.
I honestly had one of the most like euphoric, wow, there's people around me that share a similar feeling and thought process and like singing with you and stuff. I just thought it was amazing. And that was probably early days of me going into this research, to be honest, especially within the world of singing. And when you look into it, we basically have this system called endorphins, this chemical within our brain and body. And the reason we actually have it is to help us deal with physical and mental stress. And to give you a really simple analogy, in the wild, if you're faced with fighting an animal or something like that, endorphins basically rush throughout your brain and body. They take stress out of your mind so you can focus on the task at hand. And they, if the animal was to hurt you, it takes pain out of your body so that you can cope with the pain that's taking place. Something like morphine, for example, the drug we have in hospitals, morphine takes all the pain out of an area. Morphine was built off of our understanding of this system. And with endorphins, as I say, they de-stress our mind. The way in which we build them is by physically like exerting our body in some way, like getting our body to do something. That's why exercise is like always the thing you associate. And singing, and particularly like not just like a little bit of singing, but actually properly singing, it does put our body through physical exertion. It makes our throat active, it makes our chest active, and the endorphin system just pumps like crazy. And endorphins are really underactive in our world of just like sitting on our phones and computers, and singing would be like a counter to that effectively.
Wow.
It's good stuff.
This is good stuff, man. This is like, this is validating everything I'm doing. I'm getting the dopamine rush because I'm being validated.
You are, which is good. The whole singing process, I was thinking about it on the train, like the process you take people through, because it affects that endorphin system, the actual singing. We have the dopamine, which is really about like focus and pursuit of a goal, and it really zones you in. You get super into a meditative state there. Oxytocin, the second one, was all about connecting humans together, so you achieve that. And then serotonin, the calming of the body, like you're breathing throughout that singing process and stuff. So like the dose process of all four, you're honestly optimizing it for them.
Wow.
They're dose. Optimized.
That's a really good acronym. We'll remember that, dose. Dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and...
Endorphins.
I want to remember that.
This is what we need the kids to be doing. We need them all singing in groups. Because all of their doses are so far off. The TikTok's killing their dopamine and oxytocin. They're just like really socially not as able to connect and stuff. Mm. And these are the kind of practices we really need.
Social media and children. Let's talk about that.
Yep.
Tragedy.
It's honestly heartbreaking, to be honest. Like I really like to take like the very optimistic, positive view of mental health and keep my content like in that direction. But the quantity of like self-harm and suicide and stuff like that in teenagers is wild. If you go into teenage wards in hospitals now, there's like a lot of kids there as a result of this kind of stuff. Social media is really tough. It affects how our brain works. It's also a platform like TikTok educates a lot of young people on these ideas like self-harm and suicide and OCDs and anxieties, and it's like perpetuating the problem effectively. So we have to get super, super clear as to how society is going to navigate this social media thing.
It's a serious thing. It's like, you know, someone called social media and even just like technology weapons of mass distraction.
You
know, it's like we're really having to deal with I'm actually a little bit scared for my own children. Like, I've got a 2-year-old and a baby girl, and it actually genuinely freaks me out as to the world in which they're stepping into and you know, the kind of content that they're going to be subjected to. And a lot of the time, stuff that we don't even have choice over. It's kind of stuff that you're thrown. Like, I noticed on Instagram, I'm scrolling recently, and even on stories, if you keep tapping, every other story is an advert. And it's all algorithmic, I get it, and you know, they're showing me stuff that they think would be interesting for me to pursue and purchase eventually. But that really scares me, and what I've always wondered is, how do we kind of navigate that as spiritualists? Does that mean we just amp up the amount of content that, you know, we put out that's maybe of value? Like, for example, all the stuff that you're doing, it's like I fully, fully love the content that you're putting out, because it's really helping people to understand the different layers of what they're experiencing and the different layers of social media and the different layers of anxiety and mental health, adversity, etc. What would you say is the solution from our perspective? What can we actually do? And even for the listener, what would we do to try and help both younger generations, but also ourselves, mm-hmm. we're dealing with social media.
Yeah, there's kind of two sides to it. One is how you're actually spending your time inside the platform, and then how do you actually build like a really disciplined habit that gets you off of your tech where you can recharge your brain effectively. Right. Because for so many people, there's just very, very, very little time where they're not on it. Like, for example, when we train schools, they all go through like testing processes so I can learn about like what their challenges are and how they're spending their time and stuff. And I was doing lots of touring in Europe last year, and we had all of the screen times from like the month of August before I was kicking off in September. And August is obviously like a summer holiday for these kids. So you have like free rein on your phones. Mm. And for like 15-year-olds, we had average daily screen times of 17 and a half hours a day, which is a lot of time. And most of them were about 12 hours of TikTok a day. And like,
wow,
our brain can't do 12 hours of TikTok a day, because it like, regardless of the content you're consuming, like your brain just can't cope with all that pleasure. It's just like if we were taking drugs all day, drinking all day, like we'd feel like crap.
Just numb.
Numb and just like, we can go deep into how the pleasure system works later on, but that's a lot. So in terms of when you're on the content, becoming much more like mindfully aware of how the content is impacting how you feel is really important, because content might make you a bit anxious or stressed, but we're kind of getting numb to these things. So we might just consume like some stressful news and then something else that makes us anxious. So you have to actually consume with a bit of awareness. And then how algorithms work on social media is, as soon as you're on a post, a timer is effectively counting you.
Really?
That's how it's watching you. And every like second you spend on there, it's thinking, do they like or not like this content? Are they enjoying it or not? So rather than just thinking about whether you're commenting or liking or anything like that,
how long are you on
there? It's just how long you're on there. So once you build the awareness, you need to start realizing that content that makes you anxious or low, you need to swipe past it as fast as you can, effectively. And content that makes you feel good, you just need to pause for a second on there. And that's how the algorithm will learn. But right now, like something like loads of guys struggle with how much like soft porn, like the sexy girls dancing around on social media. But it's like very tempting to look at it because they're nice looking people. And that sort of thing. If you start swiping past it quickly, it will leave the feed because the system thinks you don't like it anymore. So time spent on it and awareness of how it impacts you is really important. And then in the evenings specifically, we really need a window of time where we commit to ourselves every single evening. We'll be off the phone. And we have this concept in society. We've had ages of fasting, like fasting from food. That's been a staple in many religious practices. Yeah. And we teach a lot about phone fasting, so getting off of the tech. And we get everyone committing themselves to 60 minutes every evening, where it'll be time with their family, or even if you're watching TV, see if you can bear the idea of just watching the TV, which people now struggle with. Like most of us.
I mean, that used to be the thing that people were scared about, right? TV.
I know. And it's so funny, because if I could now get all the kids in the schools I train addicted to TV, that would be like a huge success, effectively. Wow. TV was the worry. TV is nothing on our brain and social media. So time spent on it, much more aware of how it impacts you, and seek for the positive stars of content that uplift you. And then committing yourself every day to a practice, just like committing to a meditation practice, 60 minutes every evening off the phone, very important.
Wow. You spoke about kind of dealing with the instant pleasure, the nature of pleasure. And you said we'll talk about, let's just dive straight in. From the spiritual perspective, that, you know, the path that I'm on, Bhakti Yoga, it talks about how pleasure is temporary, especially that of this world, temporary pleasures, and that we should be striving and we should be reaching for that which is eternal. And that is, you know, a connection with divinity, understanding that the material body is only going to give you temporary pleasure and ultimately frustration. And so do you have any words of wisdom on dealing with pleasure consciously?
Yeah, for sure. Like this is definitely one of the greatest challenges of the modern world. Like we've set it up in a way that there's just pleasure everywhere you turn.
Everywhere.
Food, alcohol, social media, porn, like all this stuff. There's just pleasure anywhere you turn. And it's very cool when you go into the science of how this actually works in our brain. So if I was to ask you the question, if that's all right, in your world of kind of spiritual practice, are there any things that are hard that you do, like any things that take commitment and take hard work in order to do them?
Yeah, there's a practice which I chant every day for a period of maybe 2.5 hours on what can be considered like rosary beads.
Okay.
I call it japa.
Oh, Ravi said he did something like this.
Yeah. So I chant japa every single day for 2.5 hours. And so that's definitely rewarding, but it's also challenging, if I'm honest. Most of the time it does take a lot of discipline and it's a commitment.
Okay, so that's a good example of something that's hard.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for asking. So we have this system in our brain called our hypothalamus.
Yeah.
And you can imagine it's basically above the roof of your mouth. So it's sitting like deep in there, hypothalamus. In the hypothalamus, dopamine is getting created.
Okay.
And what's super interesting is we can basically experience pleasure and then we can also experience pain. We have these like two states that can be experienced. And what this area of the brain has decided to do is what's called co-locate them. So like we've basically got pleasure and pain sitting next to each other.
In the hypothalamus.
In the hypothalamus.
Okay.
The ability to experience these things.
Yeah.
And they're sitting next to each other and they're actually designed that they work on a seesaw effectively so that you can imagine for all of human survival up to this point, when we suddenly built all the buildings and made everything pretty comfortable, life was like extremely hard. Like imagine what it was like to survive like cold winters and find food and shelter and all this kind of stuff, predators. And with that in mind, how the system is designed is we needed to effectively enjoy pain. It needed to feel good putting loads of effort in effectively. So if we went through hard things, we were out in the night hunting, cold, whatever it may be, the pain system would go down on the seesaw, so experiencing lots of pain, and the pleasure system would reward us for doing it effectively. So it'd make us feel good about the fact we're doing these things so that we'd keep doing them, we'd stay alive.
Mm.
On the other side, if all we did was pleasure, so you had some people in the tribe that were like, I'm not going to contribute, I'm just going to sit back with my girlfriend and have fun and not do anything, and they only did pleasure, it would make them feel awful so that they would eventually think, right, I've got to contribute now. So it'd tip you into pain if you only had pleasure. And when you look at our modern world, a huge amount of our life is pleasure. So you wake up, TikTok feeds or whatever you may do, eating sugary cereal in the morning, all these things, loads of pleasure for the brain. And our brain has no choice but to literally put us into pain to try and say to us, don't do that. Like, you can't do that.
Wow.
Something like your activity there, that is pain. That's something that's really hard. And as you described it as, it's rewarding. It makes you feel good afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we need way more practices in our life that are actually hard. This is why something like cold water immersion has become so popular now, because cold water immersion is the like extreme of that idea. It's like, right, I'll freeze myself to death.
That makes so much sense.
The pain system's like, oh my God. And then the pleasure system goes crazy afterwards as a result.
That makes so much sense. Because I'm like, what's everyone doing? This is crazy. Like, why would you purposely do it? And now that I look back on it, I'm like, yeah, why would I purposely subject myself to 2.5 hours of Japa chanting on beads when, yeah, it makes so much sense, like, why they're doing it. Because that's a really good analogy, isn't it? I'm looking at the people in the room. Thumbs up all around. Far out analogy. Thank you.
And that's like a big thing to learn. It's like, we're going to keep doing the pleasure stuff. We're going to keep doing our social media and having our nice food and these different things.
Yep.
We can reduce it and be disciplined around it. But you have to do hard things. That means like working hard, means exercising hard. Even something as basic as like when you're like, oh, I really need to tidy my house. And you think, oh, I can't really be bothered. And you procrastinate it. And then eventually you do it. And during it, you start thinking, oh, this feels kind of good actually now I'm tidying the house. And then afterwards, you feel like a massive reward and accomplishment. And that is, you've just done something that's hard work effectively. Mm. And when we look at something like depressive symptoms, depression is really correlated with way, way too much pleasure in the brain, and the dopamine system crashes out and you start like losing the drive to do hard things. So then getting up, showering, eating food, working becomes really difficult when you're in a depressed state. And although it seems like so counterintuitive, the only way out really is to start doing some hard stuff. And it'd be tiered to wherever you are. That might be walking to the shop and buying some good food and cooking it. Like, that's an activity that's effort. You start gradually building hard work back into your life, and it can really help with this system.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I mean, you've explained that way clearer and way more effectively and simplified it way better than anywhere else I've heard it. So thank you so much for doing that, man. Wow. You mentioned the P word, and we've not yet discussed it with anyone else, but because you've said it twice now, I thought it could be interesting to dive into, because, you know, porn is something that I think a lot of men struggle with.
Yeah, for sure.
And you also mentioned how TikTok, you know, the amount of soft porn that's out there that people are scrolling by. And now that you've mentioned that you stay on it for long enough, then it's not even about liking it. You just get more content because you've been on that timer for long enough.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a practice where abstinence is key. It's one of the core founding principles that, of which there are four, like no intoxication, no illicit relationships, sexual relationships outside of marriage, no meat eating, and no gambling. These are four things which, you know, nowadays it's like if you don't do any of these four things, you're living a very boring life.
But
let's zero in on pornography, because in one sense, people would say, oh, if you're not engaging in sexual activity with someone else, then it's okay, right? That you're not harming anyone, but you're harming yourself, right? And maybe you can give us a little bit of info on that.
Yeah, this is an interesting topic, because it was something I never really planned to start talking about online. Like, I didn't necessarily want to be the guy that's chatting away about porn. And I was someone that grew up just like Googled stuff when I was in my teenage years, discovered that
world,
thought, wow, look at this. This is pretty crazy, super stimulating for your brain. And never thought anything of it. Just saw it as a part of my life, as I think many men do, but it's just like, and women, but it's just like an unspoken component of our society that we're just not considering could be influential. Again, if you look at the timelines of mental health and something like this getting really popular, you could see a big, big correlation. And for me, it was something I was just very curious, what happens if you don't watch it? And I was studying the dopamine system, this like pleasure system. Dopamine, for context, is all really responsible for our motivation, our drive. I wanted to build a good career. I wanted to build the company. And I thought, is this something that's zapping some of my drive away? And I started just doing it. Like, I'd do 2 weeks without watching it. And I thought, wow, I can feel like a big difference here. I started recommending it to my friends. They're like, what? It doesn't do anything. And they would take 2 weeks off and then message me like, this is crazy what it's done to how driven I feel. And there is like a neuroscience component to this. And then I think there's a spiritual kind of divine component, which is the neuroscience. You are just crashing out the dopamine system. So it's taking your desire away. Like, you think of the pleasure it gives you. If you get loads of pleasure off something, it's forced to like crash out to rebalance itself effectively. On that pain pleasure balance thing I was just describing, you can imagine that's like a really extreme one. So that's a component. You have the impact it really has on male confidence, which is really, really significant. And this is why super controversial figure of Andrew Tate, and we don't need to talk about Andrew Tate. However, one of the things he recommended to men was to not watch porn, which obviously for some men who were like following that narrative, that's one thing that could be useful for them, because they came off it and their drive went up. Confidence can go up when you're away from it. And the other side of it is what you're creating when you're doing that act is a really powerful thing. It can literally create a human. And deeper than the science goes, I just think that if you're just constantly getting rid of that, and I think this is why abstinence is powerful within religious practice, if you're just constantly getting rid of it, you're just taking away like a life force energy of you, of yourself too regularly, effectively. And if you can store it, just like how a boxer isn't allowed to for like 3 or 4 weeks before a fight, it's the same thing. And we need like a lot of hunger and fight for life in our world of kind of laziness and stuff like that.
Yeah. A lot of people actually ask me quite regularly, like, where do I get all the energy from? Like, to be able to do a podcast and like weekly events and then travel to festivals and then hold a retreat. And then there's so many different limbs to the project that I'm trying to share spirituality through. And my most common answer is actually stop watching porn.
Wow, that's wild.
If you actually can somehow control that energy and place it elsewhere through creatively trying to output it elsewhere, you'll be amazed by how much time you find and how much energy and how much cognitive strength you'll find, how much intellectual strength. You know, it's actually been probably the key reason. Okay, fine. Maybe I can also attribute it to my chanting, you know, on japa and on the mala that I chant on, and also the reading of spiritual texts. And of course, it all is, it's cumulative. It's not just one path. But I think that men have become servants and slaves to their devices and www dots, you know, late at night when no one else is watching. And His Holiness Radhanath Swami, he said it probably most aptly. I mean, this quote has always stuck with me. He said, the character of a person can be told by what they do when no one else is watching. The character of a person can be told.
Wow, that's powerful.
No? And when we really think about the times in our lives where we are completely alone and no one else can see what we're doing, you know, the social media world won't know, you know, who will know? Only my IP address will know. You know, in those moments where we are completely alone and we choose to act in particular ways, that's when we can tell how much advancement spiritually or how much advancement in my character have I developed. And I think that what you're doing is flipping amazing, because, you know, the clique and the niches of how many people will listen to what I say, because it's got a spiritual context, automatically people switch off. They think, okay, spiritual, God, divinity, that's included in his narrative, so therefore it's not for me. But when someone like you is coming into the world and and sharing from the perspective of science and neurology. I think it's it fills me with a great sense of joy. So I'm deeply appreciative, deeply appreciative that you're doing the work that you're doing. What's your motive? Go on. What were you going to say?
We just really need this stuff.
Yeah, man.
Like we need spiritual practice 100%.
Yeah.
Humans were not like a scientific being for most of time. Like
right. We weren't.
This is a brand new idea. And we're learning loads about being a human. And it's amazing. And it sounds funny to say these things. It kind of invalidates the fact I'm in such a scientific world. But we just need, like, we need to connect to a community. We need some of these practices in our lives. And as someone that's just like a very stereotypical westernized man who was never growing up connected to this stuff, and then I've been through my own like mental health journey with it all, and we really do. And I think what's very interesting is I went through, like, from about 15 to 20, went through a period of losing quite a lot of people in my life, passing away, people that didn't necessarily reach the typical age that you'd go. They died younger than that.
And sorry to hear.
Thank you, brother. And that kind of wakes you up to the idea of, is there something else? Is there like a deeper meaning of life and stuff like that? Because you're trying to like rationalize the concepts in your head. And that period, I think, is a big reason why I'm in this whole psychology space, because it was moving me forward, like maybe in like maturity from where my friends are at. So I was just thinking quite deeply and talking to my family a lot. And I even had a friend recently who lost his dad about a month ago. And immediately he'd be very happy for me to share this, but immediately he started asking more spiritual questions to me, saying, do you believe in that kind of stuff and things like that? And I was saying, yeah. And it's very interesting, like, when you're in pain, how much our brain naturally orients towards these ideas. And I think the disconnection from them is not good. I think we need to like re-educate and re-understand how this stuff isn't necessarily like a woo-woo concept at all.
Yeah,
hopefully this neuroscience behind it can help.
Mate, it's doing wonders. I mean, I really genuinely hope many, many listeners come to this podcast, because it really does give a lot of strength and faith for me. I mean, speaking about loss, and you mentioned that you lost a few people when you were younger, tragically, because, you know, they're before their time. And I just recently also have just gone through a process of grieving the loss of a spiritual teacher and a mentor. Yeah, you know, like, you have the theory of understanding that life is eternal, you know, that the spirit soul goes on beyond the body. And I've got all the spiritual understanding, but grieving through the loss has been something that I found challenging, and I'm still finding challenging. And I think that it would be, I don't know whether you, this was definitely not part of the plan of a conversation, but it's navigated in that way.
Yeah.
Do you have any words of wisdom on loss, on dealing with loss, on mentally, neurologically dealing with loss? How does that kind of all fit into the human experience?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how we kind of meet the experience of it happening, especially in this age of distraction world where it's quite easy to kind of ignore these emotions that come up. And emotions largely very much housed within like our body. That's why you like literally feel the pain of like sadness and grief and stuff. You feel it in your stomach and things like that. And very interestingly, when you, the gut and stuff, the gut brain axis, and the gut's getting really known as like a scientific place now where there's a lot going on. For some context, we don't just have these neurons in our brain that are like all the connection in there. We also have neurons in our gut, which is like a fairly new discovery. We actually have the same amount of neurons in our gut as a cat has in their brain. And you think a cat's a very sophisticated animal.
What? Is that real?
Yeah. Same amount of neurons in our gut as a cat does in their brain. And a cat's like absolutely thrive in the jungle. Very, very intelligent species in our world. And from the idea of what you're saying there, allowing yourself the space to feel the emotions in your gut is like one of the biggest parts of the grieving, because your nervous system hasn't necessarily got all the thoughts and rationale of your brain. It just has a lot of feeling inside it effectively. And it needs time to try and normalize the fact of like this new reality that you're experiencing. And in our thoughts, we can just like create like justification and or distraction or whatever it may be. But giving yourself space, like going out into the quiet in nature, would be the best place, because nature is just like where our whole nervous system settles. Mm. And like actually meeting these thoughts, crying, allowing yourself to like think through and celebrate that person, it's very important to like connect into that inner feeling. And from a scientific perspective, you can definitely validate that.
Yeah, I think maybe it's when I was younger, I didn't struggle with it so much, but as I've gotten older, I've struggled with the process of crying. And I think that maybe it's because I'm surrounded by the stereotype that real men don't cry, or, you know, that that's something we've had to grow up with, maybe in our generation. Maybe the next generation doesn't have to experience that. But yeah, any words of wisdom on the process of crying and how it's necessary? And does it mean that, yeah, the Andrew Tate thing that, you know, real men, what is a real man?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is an area I've been diving deeper into recently. I actually did a speech last night in Switzerland about this topic of, not in Switzerland, but virtually in Switzerland, about masculinity. And we discussed the Andrew Tate topics. It's very, very influential on the young male brain at the moment. Crying is something that is extremely good for a human being. Like, it's a there's a reason like our body has the capacity to do it. It also actually makes the endorphin system, that pain system, fire like crazy. It actually really de-stresses us biochemically when we cry. And I think the whole masculine value thing has got really, really confused, because there's this idea of super masculine man, and that means that you are effectively nasty and oppressive to women. But that's not necessarily true. Like, being a man that has the capacity to be resourceful and provide and confident and physically strong, but then also kind and celebratory of like women and stuff like that, is 100%. I think that's maybe what a more masculine man technically is. And I think many men are struggling because the feminist movement, which is beautiful and of course extremely good, we definitely need an equal world, has led to many men, I think, like slightly fearing how they should behave, and 100%. As a result, becoming like a little bit weaker in their self.
Definitely.
And there's no doubt that a masculine man would be quite a strong and confident man, because they had to survive and be pretty resourceful for 400,000 years outside. It would have taken a lot of confidence effectively to be a man and survive those kind of situations. And I think we really need to have like a meeting of this conversation where we understand like a masculine man can be very kind to women, and if you're a resourceful man, that's also good for women. But it doesn't mean women can't be resourceful themselves. But it's like we need this like merging of the two ideas, because I think many people are very confused on this.
Yeah, topic. It's not this or this. It can be this and this, you know.
100%. 100%. I think men struggling with confidence, being very addicted to the porn and stuff, that's probably one of the leading messages I get in my DMs all the time. Like, men just struggling with how to be like a man that's doing something with their time and able to connect with women and stuff like that. So this is why the Andrew Tate thing stormed so fast, because although obviously ridiculously controversial, has said horrible things,
Sure. He
was like a man that at least was demonstrating some masculine values that men admire. And suddenly men had someone to look up to, and it was like, wow, look, there's some man that we can look up to, because there isn't that many men for us to like role model at the moment, which is confusing.
You can be that person.
It takes some work, but we'll see you one day.
Yeah, for sure. This has been super interesting. I mean, is there anything that you wanted to speak about that's off the, we've done this only once before, but off the cuff, anything that you feel would be interesting for listeners to hear?
I'd love to know how I could integrate the singing practice that you deliver into my life, because typically I'm just singing normal songs, and that's a good time. I enjoy singing the normal songs. Not that your songs aren't normal, but they like have more of
abnormal.
They have more of like a deep-rooted idea in them. How could I integrate that kind of thing into my life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that kirtan and mantra music is something that's on the rise. I mean, just recently they added it as a genre on the Grammys.
Wow,
chant music is now officially a celebrated genre. And I think that it's becoming more and more popular. And I think people are asking this question, how can I integrate it more and more? And I think it's just as simple as just taking a few moments in your day to just sit and be peaceful and meditate, maybe to have a precursor to just be peaceful and be present. And then maybe just start with some ohms, simple one-syllable om mantra.
Okay.
People have seen it on the movie, so it's not, you know, something that people won't know what to do. Just sit there and chant om, close your eyes, hear the sound vibration. And that one sound vibration, that one-syllable om, is said to be the first sound vibration in creation. according to the Vedic science.
Okay.
So it's the sound vibration which brings about clarity, it brings about peace, it brings about purity, it brings about, all the good stuff, basically. And that one syllable could be a good starting point. And obviously, once you've got to a point where you want to experience more of the musical side, just jump into a kirtan. Come and join me on a Friday night at Om Nom.
Yeah.
If you're not so far from Islington, then that's our homestay and we're always there. And I think that chanting in groups, it brings a sense of community where you feel that I'm not alone on my spiritual journey.
Yeah.
See, a lot of people come to kirtan that don't actually fully enjoy the actual singing and dancing process, but they find that they finally find a community where they can express their spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that singing groups, I'm sure there's definitely going to be some scientific research.
100%.
So I think that that's a good place to start. Start by yourself, peacefully. Chant Om, maybe set a timer for maybe 5 minutes.
And are you doing, you just chant Om and you do it for as long as it can last, like in terms of your breathing,
yeah.
And then you stop and you take a deep breath and start again? Is that
so? It could be linked with the pranayamic process of using your breath.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could even be used where you just hear the sound vibration. It doesn't need to be focused on the breath. It doesn't need to be focused on how long before you run out of breath. But just hear the sound vibration.
Okay.
You know, Bhaktivedanta Swami, he was once asked, what's the best way to chant? And he said, just try. So make an endeavor. Just try to hear yourself chant sincerely.
Oh, that's good.
Sincerely means that you try to enter into the meaning of the mantra. What is it that while you're chanting, what's the intention behind the chant? And in that way, sincerely chanting with some endeavor, you'll notice really quickly, like it's almost like within the first time you sit there and just peacefully chant, Om. You'll notice all that the buzzing thoughts of the mind start to slowly just go calm down, and it gives you a focal point. Like I found it really hard to just meditate in silence, if I'm honest, because of what you spoke about. We can't be silent for more than 20 minutes, you know, without the headphones or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But attaching a sound vibration, attaching an intentional meaning behind a mantra, mate, it's done wonders for me.
And how can you put a meaning behind the Om word? Like as I'm thinking with the arm, as much as it'd be blissful if I wasn't thinking.
Right.
What kind of, is there a like standardized meaning behind what I'm doing, or do I create a meaning?
Yeah, I mean, I think a nice way is to just think that this, by chanting this, it's going to create clarity. So you can even, when you chant Om, just even bring in that word clarity, or bring in the word peace, or bring in the word purity. And just those one words, and if it's, and with time, you'll be able to add longer mantras with deeper meanings, like mantras like, I don't know, Ram, Sita Ram, which bring about an invocation of joy and pleasure and connecting with the source of joy. And so, yeah, with time, you can increase the complexity of the chants. But yeah, for someone that's starting off with chanting, Om is simpler enough.
Okay. I want to do it. I also have a housemate that's very open-minded.
Bro,
I recently moved in.
You know where I am.
True. True.
Come along.
We would get pretty into that.
Yeah, bring some T, what are they called? TRFIs?
What are those
things that you...
Oh, fMRI.
FMRI.
Let's scan the brain.
Bring some fMRIs, we'll get it on camera and we'll video it. Quickfire?
Yeah.
One word, one sentence.
Oh, wow. One word or one sentence.
Yeah, I mean, one word some people struggle with. So one word or a sentence. Something that you're curious about right now.
Impact of saunas. Studying
really?
That. Yeah, saunas are, I'm going more words immediately.
Yeah, that's fine.
Impact saunas, they're insane for our health.
Is it?
Turns out in the tribal communities, they're actually building mud huts and putting fire inside them and like heating themselves for multiple hours a day. They're now finding loads of that.
So what about Wim Hof and the ice thing?
Just both exposures to extreme can be quite good. Like I get given the comfort of the world now.
This could be a new niche, you know, because everyone's on the ice thing right now.
Yeah.
Get on the sauna hype.
The saunas are an absolute joke. Me and my friend have started doing 30 minutes each day now in the sauna, basically cooking ourselves each evening. And
I can do the heat. I can't do the ice.
That's all right. You don't have to do all these things that people recommend. You've got 2.5 hours of meditation.
Yeah, I know, mate.
I think most people would rather the ice, to be honest.
10 minutes in the ice.
So yeah, saunas, definitely studying that a lot.
Wow. I'd love to hear more about that. What's something you're personally working through at the moment?
My idea of what I want my next kind of relationship to look like. Mm-hmm. I would say so. I went through a breakup early last year with a girl that I was super in love with at the time and had been with her for like 2 or 3 years. Thought it might be the right direction, but it just didn't feel quite like the right thing. And I'm someone that's always like kind of had these, I've had a number of long-term relationships, and I'm just trying to like restabilize and figure out what I want that to look like for me.
May it happen, my friend. May it be. In short, what legacy would you like to leave behind in the world?
Wow.
That's not a quick fire question, people.
A calmer young mind, I would say, helping the young people calm their minds down. I think we need like a very sophisticated education process for young people to cope with the world we're building. And if we can figure out a way to help them like settle their uneasiness as they grow up, I think that'd be life changing.
Yeah, I'm not one to give blessings because I have no blessings to give, but may it be, my friend. That would be a wonderful world to live in. Number four, what's something that you deeply value, something you used to deeply value but don't value as much anymore?
Partying super hard. I used to value that. I think that was a big part of my growing up years, and have discovered reining that in significantly. Yeah. And creating social connection that's not always dependent on the party component,
yeah,
I think has been pretty life-changing. And I think many people could probably do with a little bit less of the booze and stuff.
Yeah. Our mutual friend Jay Shetty says it's called JOMO, the joy of missing out.
The joy of missing out. Yeah. That is true. I actually went through this on Saturday night. I don't normally have FOMO too bad, but I had a speech on Sunday morning at 6 a.m. that was in Japan to like a big group of Japanese kids. I don't typically have 6 a.m. speeches on Sundays, but it was a cool opportunity.
Yeah.
So I had to really just like go for a very calm Saturday night. And I did try and get myself into that headspace of like, this is good. I'm having a nice chilled evening, more sleep. Yeah. I've got my tracker that measures my health. And I was like, this is going to be great for the tracker. So you got to find the joy in missing out. Yeah,
definitely. And last question, if you could create one law that everyone had to follow in the world, what would it be?
That everyone takes like a 90-minute break off their phones collectively in the evenings.
Yeah, fast.
I think if we could create like a real disciplined relationship with the phones, because the tech is just amazing. It's educating us, all this stuff. But we all just need to commit to breaks from it around our families, around like time we connect with people, sometimes around our work with the distraction. So like a law around the phones is...
That could be a cool book title, Fast From Your Phone.
Yeah.
Fasting from phones.
For sure. And I'm someone that's like super techie, love social media. I love all this stuff, but we just got to have breaks from it too.
Copyright it, people. Copyright it. Fast from phones. Thanks, TJ.
Thank you so much for having me, man. Such good questions.
Yeah, this has actually been a really good, really good. I mean, every single podcast that we have on For Soul's Sake is really good. But this has been also super special, a good addition to our season. So thank you so much for being here, for making things so clear. So, your thought process is definitely unique. You've got a Jay Shetty-esque, kind of like very clear. Your answers were given in a way where it's very systematically understandable, even for someone that has no affiliation with neurology or neuroscience or even a scientific way of thinking spiritually. You're doing leaps and bounds. You're doing stuff that really helps me in my cause, you know, in being able to disseminate spiritual knowledge to other people and being able to say that, yeah, if you don't believe that this is actually working, go check out my friend TJ Power, because he's going to be able to explain how it's actually mentally working. So, deeply appreciative of your time, deeply appreciative of your ability to share with us. And to each and every one of you that's listening, thank you, thank you, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules to be with us. If you found there was some value, go back, hear it again. Take the permission to re-listen to this episode. It doesn't have to be just a 45-minute or however long, you know, just time of enjoyment and entertainment. I genuinely want to give you information and education that will stimulate your connection with spirituality, with holistic wellness. And I hope that there was some growing that happened throughout this episode. I hope to see you again next week for another episode of For Soul's Sake. And for soul's sake, give this a share, give it a like, and share the conversation far and wide. See you all next week. Lots of love. Namaste. For soul's sake, for soul's sake, for soul's sake, for soul's sake.